Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Thursday morning, May 8th, not too much of a chance for showers today, Peyton Malone says, but tomorrow you can look for an all-day rain, and then Saturday and Sunday, Mother's Day weekend, about a 50-50 chance for showers throughout the day, and then we get into our summertime pattern because we're approaching mid-May, and what else can you expect? The Fed met yesterday, and back in the day, we didn't even know what the Federal Reserve was, let alone monitoring every meeting. Greg McBride joins us now, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate, to talk about it. How you doing, Greg?
Good morning, Tommy. Great to be with you.
Yeah, I like the old days better when, you know, it's like in the movie The Other Guys when they thought the Federal Reserve was a prison. You know, it was better when we didn't know about all of this. Tell me, before we talk about what the Fed did yesterday, where did the big focus on the Fed come from all of a sudden?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it traces back to the financial crisis and maybe even before that, the recession after the dot-com bust. You know, that was the point where personal finance went from being a spectator sport to a participatory sport, mm-hmm. right? Just the broad impact on households that were felt in each of those two recessions. And the Federal Reserve, I think, at that point really became, in the mainstream, if you will, in terms of people's awareness, just because of the volatile swings that we had seen in interest rates during periods where, you know, the economy was reeling to, you know, when the housing market was going gangbusters and then, you know, down to zero at the great financial crisis. So, you know, it's had a relevant role, in the pocketbook issues of households going back the past couple of decades. I think that was, if I had to kind of, pinpoint something, mm-hmm. I think that was the turning point.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, somebody texted in, we take things for granted, Greg, and they said they still don't know what the Federal Reserve is. So perhaps you can give us a brief explanation for those that don't know.
Yeah, they do a couple things. I mean, they part of their job is as a regulator of financial institutions. But, you know, what we're talking about and, what we often talk about when we mention the Federal Reserve is what's called monetary policy. And basically, they control the price of money. And they use that. They do that through interest rates. And that interest rate can be like a gas pedal or a brake for the economy. If the economy is sluggish and it needs some gas, they can cut interest rates to give the economy the juice it needs. If inflation is too high, things are running too hot, and they need to, slow it down just a little bit, well, then they press on the brake. That's what we've experienced the past several years, where they were raised interest rates dramatically to get inflation under control, and then they started to ease that back a little bit last year. For now, they're on hold, but the economy has held up remarkably well considering how high interest rates have gone.
So what they said yesterday is leave everything alone, don't touch anything.
For now, yes. There's just nothing in the economic data that really compels them to cut interest rates further at this point. That could change. We've seen consumer and business sentiment just completely fall off the table. But when you look at metrics like consumer spending or unemployment, well, you get a different picture. Things are still hanging in there quite nicely. Again, that could change. And that's what they want to buy a little bit more time, just to see if they start to see a deterioration in the labor market, if consumer spending starts to dial back. That's going to get their attention. That's the type of thing that could prompt them to begin cutting interest rates this summer.
Well, I know this could come as a surprise to people, but President Trump took to social media, and some of what he had to say wasn't very nice. He said, too late, Jerome Powell is a fool, all capital letters, who doesn't have a clue. Other than that, I like him very much. Oil and energy way down, almost all costs, groceries and eggs, in quotation marks, down. Virtually no inflation, tariff money pouring into the U.S., the exact opposite of too late and joy. Would you care to interpret that, Greg, in terms of what's true there, what's not, or how it applies to what happened yesterday?
Well, energy prices are down dramatically, but a lot of that is because of the expectation that the global economy is going to slow dramatically. So even some of the other things that you know, inflation has, you know, some of the food items where you're not seeing the inflation now that you saw a few years ago, that doesn't mean we're paying the same prices that we were a few years ago. Prices are still a lot higher than they were. They may not be going up as fast, but they're still a lot higher. And so, you know, households still feel the strain from what was the cumulative effect of inflation over a period of years. And so, you know, when you introduce the prospect of widespread tariffs that are effectively a tax on the end user, a lot of that's going to get passed on to consumers. That's going to further stretch household budgets.
So,
and so, you know, there's a certain pocketbook risk to consumers there as well.
So just I'm just going from my personal anecdotal experience, what I've experienced. Inflation, the rate of inflation might be slowing, but I've not seen any prices come down at the grocery store, or am I missing something?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, it's, you know, what matters to households is what price am I paying? And that price, it's a lot higher than it was a few years ago. And that's what people feel. And, you know, how much of that change has come in the last 6 or 12 months versus how much of it came a year or 2 years ago really doesn't matter. The fact is that price is a lot higher than it was. That really hits at the strain that households are feeling. That's one of the reasons you've seen consumer confidence fall as low as it has, because households are already strained by the cumulative effect of inflation, and they fear inflation is going to rear its head again because of tariffs. So that's really what's undermined consumer confidence.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I'll open the Oakmont Jeweler text me line at 504-260-1870. I know a lot of people are very big fans of President Trump that listen, and that's fine. But have you seen, just in terms of what's true or not, have you seen grocery prices come down? Because sometimes I think President Trump thinks that just because he says it, it becomes true. And while the rate of inflation might be down, I don't know that I've seen almost all cost groceries and eggs, for example, down. I've not seen the prices come down. But if you have, let me know at 504-260-1870. 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Greg McBride, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate. The Fed met yesterday, decided not to lower interest rates for now. The president took to social media and said that too late Jerome Powell is a fool. So apparently he wants the Fed to lower interest rates. What is the president's strategy there? Do you know, Greg, why he wants the Fed to lower interest rates, with an eye toward what?
Well, you know, lower interest rates are favored by investors and a lot of politicians because it helps juice the economy. Mm. But we've got inflation still higher than it should be, and there's a prospect it could go even higher. So, you know, it's not the right time to give the economy more juice. You know, if all the uncertainty that's come about as a result of tariffs, if that is something that does become a drag on economic growth, well, you know, then he'll get his wish and the Fed will start cutting rates. But they'll be cutting rates because the economy is weakening. Right now, the economy is strong enough. It doesn't need lower rates.
What would happen if the Fed, if the president were to get his way and the Fed were to raise rates, in your opinion, what would happen?
Well, if the president got his way, the Fed would actually
lower rates, not raise.
The risk of doing that too soon is that it could further ignite inflation. You know, inflation's already higher than they want it to be. Everybody's bracing that it's going to go even higher because of the prospect of tariffs and stuff. So, you know, if you cut interest rates too soon, it pours more lighter fluid on that fire.
Somebody texted in and said that the grocery prices, a couple of texts have come in and said the grocery prices have definitely not come down. Other people are texting in saying that eggs and gasoline have, the price of those have come down. I don't buy eggs and gas. I never pay attention to anyway, because what are you going to do? You need it, right? You got to buy it. When it comes to the president and his control over Jerome Powell and being able to hire or fire the chairman of the Federal Reserve, how does that all play out, Greg?
Well, that's more of a legal or political question. The Jerome Powell's stance has been that the way the law is written, that the Fed is independent. You know, research has shown that countries that have an independent central bank, mm-hmm. that they have faster economic growth, lower inflation, and lower unemployment than countries that have a central bank that's directly influenced by government.
So how did he get his job? Maybe I should have asked it that way.
Trump appointed him.
Okay. So he's appointed for a term, and then when the term runs out, Trump gets to appoint somebody else, or when does his term run out?
Yeah, his term runs out next May in a year. So Trump had appointed him. He was reappointed by Biden, and his term is up at next May.
I got you. Do you think he survives and remains the Fed chairman, or does President Trump replace him with somebody that is more friendly to President Trump's way of running things?
Well, I think he's out the door next May.
Okay.
You know, as to what the replacement is, you know, that's anybody's guess at this point.
All right. So if you had to predict what's going to happen with interest rates going forward for the next either, when do they meet again? 3 months?
No, they meet again in mid-June. They meet about every 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
To answer your question, I think we'll see interest rates come down this year. I just think it's going to come down for the reason we don't want, right? We want interest rates to come down because inflation pressures are easing. We don't want interest rates to come down because the economy is weakening. There's a lot of risk to the economy right now. And I think if we do see lower interest rates through the balance of this year, that it's more likely because the economy is weakening, not because inflation pressures are receding.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate your time and your patience. Greg McBride, Chief Financial Analyst for Bankrate. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner of the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, as we do every Thursday morning here on WWL. 644, 16 till 7, not as much rain today. Tomorrow's supposed to be rain all day, then about a 50-50 shot for showers throughout the Mother's Day weekend. Then we get closer to summertime because we approach the middle of May. We welcome in Dr. Mike Strain now, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How you doing, Doc?
Man, I am doing great. You know, it's going to be a nice weekend.
Mm-hmm.
We had some rain the last few days. Mm-hmm. I tell you, the crops are in the ground, and they're doing exceptional. We're ahead of last year. You know, we've got all of our corn, you know, in the ground. We got about 30%+ of our cotton. We've got 95% of our rice planted. We've got about 6% of our soybeans, and we're rolling ahead of schedule. So that's very, very good. And so I think we're going to have a good season. You know, it's been, you know, except for that, you know, that, how you say, the freeze, that little bit of freeze mm-hmm. and snow we had, it's been exceptional. We're getting adequate rainfall, and that keeps me excited. We haven't had a lot of wildfires, and so that is good as well. So it's looking up, and look, the crawfish have never been better, but we're getting, you know, towards that end of season. So if you want crawfish, now is the time to get them. The price has come down, and everybody's having a wonderful crawfish time. Now, the farm-raised crawfish, a number of those crawfish are now going back into the farms. A lot of farmers are using them to reestablish some of the fields that they lost during the 2023 drought. But the ones coming out of the basin, the wild-caught, now they're becoming more prevalent, so that's all good.
Mike, somebody texted in. This is an interesting question about how much land would they have to get into the crawfish farming business?
Well, you don't have to have a lot, but realistically, you know, we put those crawfish ponds most commonly where we have rice fields. And so a lot of these rice farms are several hundred acres at least, but most crawfish farms, you know, 20, 30 acres, and that can be quite a lot. Just depends on, you know, what you want to do and how hard you want to work. And because the yield is going to be about 800+ pounds per acre mm-hmm. on crawfish. And so, but most time it's the ponds were rice fields because we grow the rice. We have two cuttings of rice. Then we harvest the crawfish. And the crawfish, they eat the rice stubble. So after you harvest the rice, the rest of the plant that's left, that is the vegetation that the crawfish eat. And so it's a very, very good system that's getting better and better. And then, of course, what comes after crawfish, you know, they set up and put duck blinds out there. And so the property is used for many different purposes. But it works best with the rice crawfish model. That's the best model that works.
So if you're going to go into the crawfish business, you really have to be in the rice business as well, or it makes every bit of sense?
It would be more economical. Now, they have some farmers that are not,
mm-hmm.
But you're going to have to go and probably plant some type of vegetation there. And remember, you're going to have to flood those fields and that. So the vast majority are on top of rice. That's the way it works. The model that is most successful, because again, you will have the value that you get from harvesting the rice, and you can get 8,000 to 9,000 pounds of rice per acre, and the rice is selling at about $15 a hundredweight, and so that helps to cash flow the whole operation. Because remember, you've got to get, you know, a particular type of boat. Now, you can do it by hand. They make these little hand boats that you can get behind and push in shallow water and walk and get your crawfish. But most common, you have these boats and that go into the crawfish fields. But you've got to have some infrastructure as well, and you've got to buy your traps and that sort of thing.
If you had to guess, cost the startup in the crawfish business would be what? I guess it all depends on what the situation with the land and flooding it.
Yeah, and probably you're going to have to put at least 100 pounds or plus of crawfish per acre. And so at $2 in today's price, $2.40, $2.50 a pound, so you have about $250 worth of crawfish that you have to seed in there. Then you got to build your levees and get your boats. So you're probably, if you had to start and you already had the land, you know, you're probably going to invest, you know, $500 plus to $1,000 an acre to start or more.
I think it's cheaper just to buy them from somewhere.
Oh, well, but you know, you can, you know, get a lease and do wild card. But if you have available land, but before you start, you really need to get somebody to come out there and look, especially when you're on what we say on our side of the river, because the crawfish do best at crawfish farming on the west side of the Mississippi River or in those particular areas, because, again, you have to, if you look at the soil types, and where we grow rice. So where we grow rice, you generally can grow crawfish, but they seem to work better west and then towards the central part of the state. You get around, you know, where we're at, and that just that old black mud, they don't do quite as well there.
Mike, let's talk about the legislative session, what's going on for both in D.C. with the Farm Bill and also in Baton Rouge with stuff moving through the legislature that's of import to your administration. Your department.
Well, we're start talking in Washington. The Farm Bill, you know, it just isn't moving, and that's the whole thing. And it's, you know, they keep talking about, well, we're going to try to move it, you know, in the next few weeks, and you know, they get into another battle line. And right now, this week, you know, the legislators there, our congressional delegation in the agricultural committees, are being charged with making significant reductions. As you have seen, Secretary Rollins there this week and really announcing next week, the plan is going to totally reorganize USDA, reorganization of USDA, and I'm sure that's going to be reflected in the Farm Bill. And so we'll see how that's going. 10,000 people have already accepted a payout to leave the USDA, and that is the significance, since they have over about 200,000 total employees. And then I've been talking on a regular basis with Congresswoman Julia Letlow, because she is on the Agricultural Appropriation Subcommittee, and they're really pushing hard to try to get this Farm Bill in motion. But I really don't have high hopes that they will have it passed realistically before November or December. If then, they're running into headwinds because they're trying to reorganize the SNAP portion, which is 85% of the Farm Bill, the supplemental feeding program, and they've got to get a resolution to those discussions before they can move the Farm Bill. And so trying to find the savings that they're being ordered to do and that. So what one of the discussions is that they're going to take pieces of the commodity section, which is the 15%, what we typically think of the Farm Bill. You know, we have crop insurance, we have the research arm, you know, we have soil and water conservation, and move it piece by piece through the budget resolution process. So that's kind of where that's at. I'm not real happy about that, but I know that our whole team is working hard to try to move it along. We're also looking at investing more money into foreign trade. In other words, what our job through the USDA, the Foreign Ag Service, and our states is to find, you know, buyers for our products to sell our products offshore. Because about 60% of all the soybeans we grow in the United States must be sold offshore. And so when we start looking at that, we're working on that hard. In the state legislature, let me tell you, they have been working hard. A lot of those committees start at 9:30 in the morning. Some of them go into 10 o'clock at night. We're involved in a number of pieces of legislation. One particular bill is using waste stream product. It's like an ash product called gypsum, which is calcium sulfate, and being able to utilize that after it is properly tested by my lab or another approved lab to go in the soil. And the reason is our soils have become deficient in sulfur, and we have to use about 300 pounds of sulfur per acre every 5 years on our cane land. Sulfur is very expensive, and so we're going to be able to utilize this, a byproduct, safely utilize this product again for Louisiana farmers for the sulfur that we need. So that is a big bill that we have going through. I'm also very involved in a streamlining of the seafood inspection laws. That's what Representative Kerner, and we've been working on that with the Lieutenant Governor's office, and, you know, and trying to make it to where the whole process is efficient and workable. So that is moving through the process. We have a number of bills dealing with the solar energy issues and the fact on, you know, regulating solar, where it should go, where it should not go. There's going to be a mitigation like we mitigate for wetlands. And those are bills by Guyman and Ms. Coates. And I'll be meeting with Ms. Coates and Guyman again today. The Department of Agriculture is charged, as commissioner, with issuing letters of clearance. And I'm charged with making sure that there's no viable alternative if high-value farmland is being utilized. And secondly, to set a mitigation value of what it's going to cost to mitigate that farmland or replace that farmland. And I have to look at the overall effect on the community, on the neighbors, on agriculture, and so many other factors. Those are very complicated bills, and we're moving forward with that. And then additionally, looking at all the issues with the budget, because believe it or not, this is a fiscal session. And we've heard about all the substantive language going through in the making of law when the focus generally of fiscal session is monetary. And that has not been the case here. But we're looking at the budget, working with the budget, and then looking at whatever new issues are moving forward.
How you keep track of all that and maintain a veterinarian practice, I don't understand, but you do. God bless you, Mike Strain. Appreciate your time as always, sir. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Eat some crawfish and shrimp. Don't forget about shrimp and those beautiful crabs. My goodness, you need to have some gumbo with some crabs this weekend.
Thank you, sir. Mike Strain, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, 654 and a half. Traffic now, WWL. 7:13 now on this Thursday morning. It'll be a nicer day today than it was yesterday. Less of a chance for rain. Tomorrow is going to be a steady rain all day long. Then as we get into the Mother's Day weekend, you're talking about a 50-50 shot at showers, and it's going to be hot and humid as it is every Mother's Day weekend. What is a screwworm? Are they as bad as they sound? I think they are. Christine Navarre joins us now, an extension veterinarian with the LSU Ag Center. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great.
Tell me about screw worms. What in the heck is that?
Yeah, so the primary screw worm that we're also concerned about is a special case because it's basically a maggot. So it's a fly that lays eggs in wounds. But in this case, it doesn't need like decaying flesh. So an infected wound or something like that, it can lay eggs in just normal tissue. And so, and then it can, once those eggs hatch into the larva can actually burrow into normal tissue, which is very, very, you know, it can be deadly. So it's not here, but it has been slowly marching up from Central America. It's now in very southern Mexico. And so we definitely need to be on the lookout for this pest.
Is this a new species of worm or something, or did we at one point have these things under control and then stop and they're coming back? Take me through that.
Yeah, so we actually had them in the U.S. Back. It was eradicated from the U.S. in the 60s, and then it was slowly beat back, and then they've been trying to keep it basically a barrier around the Panama Canal. Mm-hmm. But it escaped that barrier and has been slowly marching up. In 2016, there were some cases in Key Deer in the Keys, the Florida Keys, and there was a release of the sterile flies. That's how you control it, and that was controlled. But we don't want to take the chance of it getting in this country.
Wait, release of sterile flies.
Yeah, so if you release sterile male flies, then the females can't, they'll breed with those flies and they can't lay eggs. And so that's how you basically eradicate it or take it out of an area.
So you don't use poison or insecticide. You sterilize the males?
Yeah.
Really?
You sterilize the flies. And I mean, you do use insecticide. So we've got cattle that and other livestock that come across the border in from Mexico into the U.S. at USDA inspection stations, and they're inspected, but they're actually treated a few times with insecticides before they're, and then again after they're across the border, just to make sure. But you don't really want to rely on that. You want to make sure that you try to eliminate the population of those flies.
So this starts with a fly, is how it starts, or the worm, or how does it take me through the life cycle of this?
Yeah, so just like, you know, we get, you know, maggots in our garbage can, mm-hmm. or maggots, you know, in a wound of an animal or even people, it starts with a fly, and those flies lay eggs, and then the maggots, they hatch into the little larva, which we call maggots, and so these are, the only difference in these is that they're very aggressive and will burrow into normal tissue.
So what animals are at risk from these things?
Every mammal. And so livestock, pets, it's rare in people, but it can occur in people. Wildlife, we are concerned about wildlife potentially coming across the border, especially if it gets further north into Mexico. So, you know, anyone traveling to an area that would have this, you know, just take general precautions on, you know, personal hygiene. Make sure that if you bring a pet in from another country, you know, you're going to have to follow some regulations from USDA on importing those animals. And those are all there for not just for the screwworm, but for other diseases that we don't want to bring in.
So the fly bites a healthy animal, or there has to be some kind of diseased tissue?
No, in this case, why it's so bad is it doesn't need diseased tissue. So they don't really bite. They just they deposit their eggs in moist tissue. So they can deposit their eggs in, you know, like your eyes, where there's, in livestock, you know, where there's tear film in the eyes, in the umbilicus of baby calves, any open moist area, these flies can deposit the eggs. And then if they hatch, then, you know, again, and they're not found immediately, they can burrow into normal tissue.
So how did we keep a barrier against these things in Central America?
So there's a sterile fly facility in Panama, in Central America. And the idea was if we could keep them below that area, then, you know, they can't march their way north, but they somehow escape that. And, you know, once they're out there, it's very difficult. You know, if one animal, you know, one fly can deposit thousands of eggs. And so, and then if those are allowed to hatch, then you have more flies. And so it's just, it kind of grows exponentially. So that's why it's such a concern, is we really want to help Mexico. So USDA and Mexico have a joint agreement, because if we help Mexico get rid of it, then that helps us never have it again.
Let me take a break here, because I got a lot of questions, and I'm gonna stop coming to work, doctor, because it seems like every time I come to work, I find out something new. If it's not bird flu, it's something else. Now I'm hearing about screw worms, which I'm looking at pictures of this thing here, and Lord Almighty, you don't want that to happen.
Yep, we don't want it to happen.
No, how do we have the resources? We'll talk about this when we come back. The resources that we need to prevent this from happening, and is this a national effort or a state by state effort? And holy moly, I'm looking at a picture of a deer with a screwworm infection, and it's like the size of a hubcap where the worms are eating the deer. And it's, I don't mean to talk about this at the breakfast hour, but it is something that. And we'll talk about the economic effects as well if we don't get this under control. When we come back, we're talking about screwworms with Dr. Christine Navarre, extension veterinarian with the LSU Ag Center. Let's take a look at traffic now, WWL. All right, 7:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Christine Navarre, extension veterinarian with the LSU Ag Center, about screw worms that, man, just when you thought it was safe. I'm going to tell you what, doctor. So let's talk about getting ahead of this, because it seems like it's a lot harder to get rid of than it is to prevent in the first place, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's why the sterile fly release is so important, because that does have the potential to eradicate it. And so we've got to stay on top of that. And again, USDA and Mexico have a joint venture to do just that.
So is everybody getting along when it comes to this? And is the funding there? And do the necessary people realize how important this is and how you can't let it get out of hand?
Yes, I can tell you that the necessary people, so Secretary of Ag Rollins has been very involved in this issue, and they, Mexico understands the seriousness of this as much as we do, and so, funding is always an issue for everything, and so we've got to get the funding there, but we're working on it, and I think we just want people, because it's such a serious issue, and we want people just to be aware of it. And when you're, we don't share a border with Mexico, but it has, it's come into the Keys. We didn't know how it got there. Mm-hmm. So we just want people to be diligent. And if they see something, say something.
But it comes through flies, right? So I don't know how you keep that.
It can come in flies, but it can also come with animal importations. And, we can control the animals as much as possible, but we need to, wildlife is a potential source that could come across. They go back and forth. They don't really understand the borders, so that's a potential that it could come across in wildlife too.
So is there any kind of, like, when it comes to protecting the food supply, is there any kind of vaccine that you give cattle for this or not?
No, there's no vaccine, and it's really not a food safety problem, other than if it would get in the U.S., it would have a devastating effect on our, potentially on our cattle population. Mm-hmm. And so then, we might have less food and more expensive food. That's why if you look at the economic impact, it's huge. And so it might be huge to prevent it, but it's a whole, it's a fraction of the cost of trying to deal with it from an economic standpoint.
So once a mammal gets these things, can you treat the mammal? I guess for a human being, is there treatment available?
So there's common insecticides that are approved that are used for other things every day, that so it is treatable. Yes, you just have to catch it very early.
And in an animal, you would treat it or you would destroy the animal?
It would depend. I mean, if you find an animal that is obviously, in dire circumstances, mm-hmm. and not going to live, then you can euthanize that animal. But there, it's very treatable. It's just that it's very difficult to recognize before it gets really bad, because they're just very aggressive.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you about this?
I'm at about a 5. We've got things in place to take this back, but you never want to let your guard down. So.
Yeah, I wanted to hear 2, but that's okay.
That's our job.
Yeah, I wanted to hear 2, but you're being honest. That's all right. Thank you, Dr. Christine Navarre, extension veterinarian with the LSU Ag Center. Just when you thought you'd heard it all, screw worms coming in from Central America, maybe. And how do you treat them? You sterilize the males. 7:30, we'll talk with Colin Arnold when we come back about the city and hurricane preparedness week and the rain and so forth. Right now we pause for WWL First News. A heavy rainfall May 3rd, May 8th, a lot of different May dates. Colin Arnold joins us now, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans, to talk about it. How you doing, Colin? Colin Arnold. Colin, you got us on mute?
Hey, sorry about that.
That's
hey,
all right.
Good morning, Tommy.
No,
sometimes I feel like slamming the phone like that.
Hey, you're probably talking bad about me. That's why you put it on mute, but I don't blame you. Hey, let's talk about the rain and what's coming tomorrow and next week and so forth. How everything performed yesterday?
I think pretty good. You know, obviously we had some actually some straight line winds. There's no indication of, you know, any tornado activity, but straight line winds came through. Some reports 50 to 60 miles an hour, and we had some tree damage in Orleans, and we saw that also in neighboring parishes as well. So those are being addressed right now. I'd recommend any homeowner or anybody that sees tree damage in the city can call 311 and have Parson Parkways come in and address it as necessary. But the rain itself, you know, we had some areas of street flooding around the city. Not uncommon when, you know, we got about three, almost 4 inches of rain in some areas of the city within about between, say, 10 a.m. And about noon. And so not uncommon, but from everything I saw, no pump or power issues. And they were able, you know, to draw that water down within, you know, a few hours of the afternoon, and, you know, as per their procedure. So I'm always hesitant to say, but I will say I think we saw the worst of it yesterday. Today is going to be drier, and then tomorrow, you know, there may be a hit or miss shower this afternoon in the area. But other than that, I think tomorrow is going to be another day. I don't think it will be like yesterday, but in particular in the afternoon from about noon to about 5, looking at some potential for some thunderstorms and another line coming through. And then Saturday and Sunday, there's also kind of a lesser elevated chance of that type of rain in the afternoon, too. I think we're in this cycle where, you know, every 4 to 5 days we're going to get, you know, at least some sort of, you know, pop up or, you know, small front moving through the area. And we're going to be getting our spring rain.
Do you know if any cars flooded yesterday? I don't think water got in any houses in Orleans Parish, did it?
No, nothing to that extent. I mean, obviously there are some ground level residences and businesses in areas that what we call severe repetitive flood properties that, you know, we've been working over the years to try and elevate through programs with the federal government. Those are kind of on hold right now, but we're hoping to get those back. And but yeah, nothing notable about house residence flooding or vehicle flooding.
When you talk about it, and I see what happened in Marrero with the straight line winds and the rain, and as I ask you this as the director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, something like that I mean, there's nothing you can do. That's just the luck of the draw, right? Whether it happens in Marrero, that could have very easily have happened in the CBD yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. It all depends. And same with the rain, quite frankly. I mean, some, you know, some areas on the West Bank these last 2 weeks that we've had rain have been getting a lot more. It seems like the flow either goes kind of north to the North Shore or a little south of the city, which, you know, is really luck of the draw. It's always tough when you're dealing with, you know, when the Weather Service is covering an area from Baton Rouge to the Mississippi counties. You know, it's a huge area, and really it is kind of luck of the draw on who is going to get it. And a lot of times they'll tell you very clearly, like, we're very confident that there's going to be a bad weather day tomorrow, but we're not as confident on the flow and which, you know, which communities in themselves are going to be impacted the most.
I know what I deal with just a couple of oak trees on a property, and I can't imagine how you guys go about keeping the catch basins clear, because again, when I went through with Steve Nelson the other day, you know, where you got to, the water's got to get, it rains and it goes from the street, it's got to get into the drain and then go underground through the system into the canal, and it gets pumped out, and then the pumping station, of course, has the power and the pumps and so forth. But I don't know how y'all stay on top of the oak leaves. Do you have confidence that the water, that the drains are clear enough for the water to drain through with all the oak leaves and everything else in the city?
I do. You know, there's something to the order of 17 or 18,000 storm drains in the city, mm-hmm. or maybe even more. And so keeping a regular maintenance cycle on those is something that, you know, Steve and I have talked about, and you know, what that looks like. And I think more investment needs to be made into that, because what happens is, you know, we'll get an event like this, and then that brings down a lot of leaves from the trees with these winds. And then the trucks have to go out and start knocking out 311 calls and immediate issues that they know exist after a storm. And then that puts them potentially further behind with just the preventive side of going out and trying to touch every one of these storm drains in the city. You know, it's a daunting task.
Let me
take
a break.
That's why we ask for the public to help as much as we can. We're not asking people to strain themselves. We're not asking people to, dig down inside or in any way open up these storm drains and try and clean them. We're really just asking for, when you see debris, when you see leaves and things like that covering the grate, to help us out with that and pick it up if they can with a rake or a broom, just something to clear those out to make sure that at least the grates are clean.
And a quick word about lawn companies, because I get texts about this constantly, blowing the clippings into the drain.
Yeah. I mean, anything you're putting in there that shouldn't go in there, and that's, everything from leaves to sand. One of the issues with doing sandbags during hurricane season is they typically tend to get left out. The bag wears away, and then the sand ends up in the storm drains. And then the other things, crawfish water, motor oil, everything else that can potentially get in there. People cleaning out their garbage cans and dumping the water down the storm drain. Those are the things that, we really ask the public, please do not do, because it does affect that system.
Now let's talk about, when we come back, the maintenance of cleaning the drains out and so forth, and how confident are you heading in a hurricane season. We're talking to Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the city of New Orleans. Before you know it, this will be hurricane season. I hate to tell you that. Today is May 8th, 7:52, 8 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:58, 2 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans, about the rain yesterday and what's forecast for tomorrow, and about catch basins. Colin, somebody texted in, if you take the cover off of a catch basin, the pit is massive, meant to hold huge amounts of leaves and dirt with no impact on drainage. The design is very good. The entire system is designed to be self-scouring like your toilet and house pipes. Does that make any sense to you?
I don't know if the entire pit is meant for debris, but I think it's meant to hold a certain amount of water. I don't know enough about it to say, but I will say that I got a text from Steve Nelson while we were on break saying, hey, what are you doing? There's 72,000 catch basins, which I knew when I said 17. Mm-hmm. As soon as I said it, I was thinking of the fire hydrants, which is a whole other project we're working on right now since the fires in L.A. And making sure that we're addressing every fire hydrant in the city as well. So it's a never-ending kind of cycle of trying to maintain a very large system in a city.
But quickly, so, going back to the cars and everything that they pulled out of the drainage system and so forth, and the canals and all of that stuff, that maintenance is ongoing, so you're confident that everything will work properly as we had in a hurricane season?
And I think that pumping down the canals before these type of events, when we have a notice, is a huge help, because it gives that water somewhere to go and at least collect in the meantime, until we can get it pumped out to the lake or pumped to the river, depending on where the system is, and then it really does help. And so I know that they are very much, when they have the ability within a day or two to get those pumps, canals,
pumped
down.
Thank you, Colin. Gotcha. 8:13 now on this Thursday morning. Less of a chance for showers today than there was yesterday. But tomorrow is supposed to be steady rain, and looking ahead to Mother's Day weekend, about a 50% chance for showers each day. And it's going to be hot, because it always is on Mother's Day. Dr. Brent Wallace joins us now, our friend. Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm okay. How are those boxers?
They're doing okay. Crazy as usual.
That's what they're supposed to do. High blood pressure we're going to talk about today. High blood pressure is one of the most common chronic health conditions. Nearly half of Americans have it. But studies show that people don't know much about blood pressure and don't know really what a healthy reading is. And that's why Dr. B is going to explain the basics and debunk some common blood pressure myths. And I was saying before, Dr. B, the break, that, it's a relatively simple thing to treat, it seems like, but can have some very serious complications if it goes untreated. So let's talk starting with what is blood pressure?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tommy. It's very critical, for people to understand, what their blood pressure is and if it's normal. So it's a pretty simple concept. When your heart beats, it's going to pump all the blood out of your heart into your arteries. And the arteries are all those vessels that carry things around your body, carries the blood to your organs, your brain, you know, everywhere it needs to go to fuel those cells and tissues to keep them healthy. And so when the blood flows through the arteries, it's going to push against the walls of those arteries. And blood pressure is actually measuring how forceful that push is from the heart.
So how do you measure it? Because I know I have one of these blood pressure machines, and I try to sneak up on it. I know that sounds crazy because you don't want to think about it, right? And sometimes people can have high blood pressure just from having their blood pressure taken.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people can get scared. We call that white coat hypertension. Mm-hmm. And so when you see a white coat, your blood pressure goes up. But it's actually pretty easy to measure. You know, you've got the automatic machines, like the one you were talking about. We usually will use a manual cuff. That's where we pump it up and we listen to your arteries, and we actually record two different numbers. So an example would be 120 over 80. And the reason we record two numbers is because we're actually recording and listening to the force of the blood at two different times. That top number is measured when your heart is beating, and then the bottom number is measured when the heart relaxes, so in between the two beats. That's why it's got the two numbers over each other.
So what's considered a healthy blood pressure?
Yeah, so a normal blood pressure in general for adults is going to be anything less than 120 over 80. And if either number is consistently high, that's where your doctor may say, hey, you might have high blood pressure. But keep in mind, like we said, it can be variable. You know, if you get excited, if you get scared, it's going to go up. So we definitely recheck it a couple of times, usually at different visits, before we make that diagnosis. And the top number in general is a little bit better indicator of whether or not you may develop heart disease or stroke risk in the future.
What does it mean to have high blood pressure? And I always get confused because they ask you on the medical form, do you have high blood pressure? Well, no, I don't, because I take medicine and it's under control. So explain all of that, Doc.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people get confused about that. So high blood pressure really just means that blood is pumping against the artery walls at a high enough force to cause damage. And typically, medically, we will call that hypertension. If you're taking blood pressure medicine to lower your blood pressure, it doesn't mean you don't have high blood pressure, the disease anymore. It just means that it's controlled.
Hypertension is high blood pressure?
It is, yeah. We use those terms totally interchangeably, and that kind of confuses people as well.
All right, let's talk about some blood pressure myths. This is, I guess we'll call it, well, I shouldn't say that word because it might be a copyrighted term, and I don't want either one of us sued. Let's talk about blood pressure myths and just leave it at that. So let me make some statements here. You can respond to them. I feel fine, so my blood pressure must be in a healthy range.
Yeah, that's not necessarily true, and it's actually why we check your blood pressure when you come to the doctor at pretty much every time you have an appointment. A lot of people can have high blood pressure for years and years and actually not have any clue that their blood pressure is high. And the reason is, most often, especially early in the course of disease, you may not have any symptoms whatsoever. That's why we call high blood pressure or hypertension the silent killer, because there's really rarely warning signs or anything that you would recognize that may say your blood pressure is high. That's why it's so important to check it. And you can do that, like I said, when you go to the doctor. We're almost always going to check it. And you can also use those home blood pressure monitors, or some pharmacies even have a blood pressure monitor that you can actually use to check your pressure.
So what would you say to somebody who says high blood pressure is so common it can't be that serious?
Yeah, don't believe that. And, you know, it is extremely serious, but that is correct. It is extremely common as well. But the problem with high blood pressure is that increased pressure really, it increases your risk of heart disease and, in particular, stroke. And those are two of the leading causes of death in the United States. And then the other things you may not realize that elevated blood pressure can cause, but it can actually lead to problems with your kidneys. A lot of people will will develop vision problems. And by the way, if you are going to have a symptom, one of the first ones may be blurry vision. And then if you're pregnant, high blood pressure can cause a lot of complications in that pregnancy.
I was having a conversation with somebody the other day in their lower 30s, early 30s, however you say it, and they were saying they thought they might have some blood pressure problems, but they were too young to have it. And I said that's not necessarily the case. Talk about that, if you will, about people that are young not having to worry about blood pressure problems.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. You know, a lot of people don't think about it when they're younger. They don't go to the doctor as often. But you know, your risk of blood pressure, high blood pressure, does increase with age. But we very frequently actually will identify young adults, even sometimes really young adults, that have developed the condition. And about 1 in 8 people between the ages of 20 and 40 have high blood pressure and have to be treated for it. So it's not completely uncommon.
Is it a man's disease, high blood pressure?
Yeah, it's not. It's not. It really can affect absolutely anyone, regardless of what sex you are. And in general, actually, before age 65, it is more common in men. But after age 65, it actually becomes a little bit more common in women. Part of that is because women live a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. But after age 65, really, everyone does need to be concerned.
I think another part of it could be, and it's just speculation on my part, that they deal with us.
That could do it, definitely. That'll raise your pressure.
What about heredity and running in your family, high blood pressure?
Yeah, high blood pressure definitely does run in families. But if if your parents or your siblings have high blood pressure, it doesn't mean that you're absolutely going to get it. Really, what you have to think about is what healthy habits can you develop and follow that are going to prevent the condition.
That's a good stopping point. We'll talk about healthy habits to prevent high blood pressure when we come back. We're talking to Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health. About blood pressure, if you want to find out more about People's Health, you can always go to peopleshealth.com. You can call them at 1-800-978-9765. And, of course, they got the People's Health Medicare Center in Metairie, 3017 Vets. Beautiful facility. Between North Causeway Boulevard and Trader Joe's, appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. They'll be glad to sit down with you and explain everything to you that you need to know. 821 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A couple of minutes left with Dr. Brent Wallace, Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer at People's Health. We're talking about blood pressure, and we've already talked about how you can feel well but still have high blood pressure and not know it. Just because you feel okay, that doesn't mean anything. It's called the silent killer. It's common. It is serious and causes kidney disease, vision problems, pregnancy complications, age. Doesn't really matter, and high blood pressure can affect men and women equally. What about some healthy habits, Doc, to avoid getting high blood pressure, to deal with it?
Yeah, so hopefully most people have heard about these because we talk about these healthy habits all the time in treating a whole host of chronic diseases. But the American Heart Association really recommends 3 major things. You know, the first is exercising regularly. The second is really eating a well-balanced diet. And the third is not smoking. And keep in mind that those habits are not just to prevent conditions like high blood pressure, but they can actually help you manage it if you've already been diagnosed as well.
How much exercise do people need?
Yeah, so in general, you want to try to exercise at least 30 minutes most days of the week. But any exercise is good exercise, and it can really be anything that gets you up and moving around. You know, dancing, gardening outside, walking around the neighborhood, walking the dogs, mm-hmm. You know, interesting fitness classes, really just anything that engages you and gets you up and moving.
How about diet?
Yeah. Diet is really critical with blood pressure problems in particular. And so the American Heart Association talks specifically about having a diet that's really rich in whole grains and fruits and vegetables. And then low-fat dairy products are really important as well. Lean proteins, things like nuts and fish, are really helpful also.
So what kind of foods should people avoid or maybe even limit?
Yeah, the biggest ones you want to limit is anything that is high in sodium or salt. So salt actually increases your blood pressure. So if you've been diagnosed with hypertension, you really want to reduce the amount you take in. So things like deli meats or canned soups, really anything in a can, a lot of frozen meals, and especially all of those salty snacks, things like chips and pretzels, those are going to have a lot of salt in them, and that's going to increase your blood pressure.
And you can check the amount of sodium, right, by looking at the label?
Yeah, it's listed on there, and we usually tell you to keep below about 2 to 4 grams a day, or 2,000 to 400 milligrams a day, 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams.
And we can't have this conversation without talking about smoking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is consistent for decades and decades. You know, we have demonstrated that smoking cigarettes, and that can include e-cigarettes, actually has an immediate effect on your body. The nicotine actually raises your blood pressure immediately, and then it can actually make your heart beat faster as well. So it's going to actually raise your blood pressure in two different ways. And then over time, that can actually cause your arteries to narrow, so it's going to make it harder for that blood to flow and get to all the vital organs of your body. So if you are smoking, you want to talk to your doctor today about quitting.
Somebody wants to know about alcohol causing high blood pressure. Can it?
Yeah, really chronic alcohol use absolutely can cause elevated blood pressure kind of acutely when you drink. Sometimes your blood pressure can go down a little bit, but don't use it for treatment. That's not what it's for.
Somebody also wanted to know about pain. Can pain cause high blood pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that is a normal thing. Your blood pressure will go up with pain. In fact, if you're in pain and you check your blood pressure, it's likely to be high, which is why we repeat the blood pressure frequently, because we want to make sure we get a real value. But if it's consistently up, that's where you have high blood pressure as a disease.
Very valuable information. Thank you, Dr. B. Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. You can always download the Odyssey app if you want to re-listen to anything he had to say here about blood pressure, or just go to WWL.com, click on my name. And to find out more about People's Health, you can always visit peopleshealth.com online, call them at 800-978-9765, or pop into the People's Health Medicare Center in Metairie, 3017 Vets, right between North Causeway and Trader Joe's. Appointments are recommended, but they'll love to see you if you just walk in. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Mike Dettelier about Saints rookie mini camp. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, May 8th. Before you know it, the Saints will be off for the month, I guess what I'm trying to say, and come back for training camp in Metairie. But it all gets started, I guess, today with rookie mini camp. Mike Dettelier joins us now, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. Talk about it. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good, Tommy. Thank you.
I guess everybody's signed and all of the rookies are going to be there today?
Not everybody is signed, but I expect that won't take too long. You slotted today, so you know pretty much where you and what you're going to get for that length of time. And the free agents that you brought in and tryout people, you know, you've already signed those guys. But this is a sort of an orientation, early orientation, I guess, best way to put it, in that going through making sure you understand how we do things at the NFL level. It's different from high school to college to the pros. This is how we do it. And there won't be any, you know, hitting with pads or anything like that, but it's a lot of technique work and basically going through what we expect you to do from play to play.
When it comes to, like, the big guys, you call it slipper and pajama practices, but is there a lot they can tell about the Kelvin Banks, for example, or any other offensive or defensive linemen?
Their technique work, their footwork. The one thing I watch all the time with linemen is, can you move your feet and your arms in unison? Now, a lot of people say, well, anybody can do that. No, that's not quite the case. When you're going up against another 300-pound man, and when you're an offensive lineman, you understand every time you line up, the athlete that you're lining up against is a better athlete than you. you have to win with your technique work. And so that's what you can tell, Tommy, real quickly, how well they can use their hands and their feet movement skills in unison together. Some guys struggle with it, really, really do. They can get their hands out, but then can't move their feet well, or they can move their feet well, but their hand placement skills aren't very good. So this is why you have these sort of orientation and drills with the rookies and rookie free agents to get them to understand this is how it's going to be done at the NFL level. You might have been bigger, faster, stronger than other guys in college. Not the case when you hit the NFL.
Do they have to be signed before they take the field? I'm just wondering legally with injuries.
No, there's a waiver deal. Now, some agents, they'll hold their guys out. But, you know, there's a waiver deal that you could sign and actually participate.
When it comes to, like, film study and that kind of thing, do they look at any film here, or is it just like an orientation? They do look at film.
Very much so. That's a big part of this and exactly kind of what they expect you to do. And a lot of times guys come into this, they've already, you know where you're going to be at. And so you're looking at last year's film. Here's the catch with that. New coaching staff, they're teaching you something different. So there's no going back unless you're watching, say, a quarterback and you're Tyler Shucks. You can go back and watch what you saw the Eagles do with Jalen Hurts. Or you are Kelvin Banks Jr. and you can go back and see how the Eagles offensive line, their technical work. But it's a lot of film work, a lot of mental work, and it's like learning a new language. The plays are all the same, but the terminology is different.
So the coaches are looking to, is this more of a mental thing, not just physical, where they're looking to see how much this player can grasp and how they can take it from the film room to, well, not that it's film, but from the video room to the field?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I hear it a lot from coaches that are involved in these rookie sessions, is that they want to feed it to them at world record speed. Because in college, you're kind of giving it, you know, you're getting it teaspoon-wise. They're giving it to you tablespoon-wise and fast. They want to see how quickly you can process the information that's being kind of given to you. And everybody's different. Everybody's learning curve is a little different. Some guys don't quite get it right away and struggle with it. And some guys, you show it to them the first time, hey, I got it. You got to know the individual. Marcus Costa was a great example, and I know he told us the story on the Super Bowl that, you know, he comes in from Hofstra. They were throwing stuff at him. You know, he wasn't quite sure what was happening. So he said it took him a little while to pick it up because he had just never been through what was being taught to him. But he said, you know, after a period of time and rep work, he was able to pick it up pretty quickly. But those first week and a half of it, he said, you know, your mind's swimming because you don't, if you've never been through it, you don't know how quickly, you know, you can process all that information. It has nothing to do a lot of times with your intelligence, too. Sometimes some of the smartest guys, I think they over kind of think things at times, you know, and it doesn't process nearly as quickly. It takes them a little while. So, yeah, it's a good question, and it is all about I'm going to throw this stuff at you, and I want you to tell back to me what I just explained to you.
You know, as you say that, Mike, it reminds me until maybe my senior year in college, every time the semester would start, I would freak out because they'd hand out the syllabus and I'd panic. And it's like, I don't know anything about this. How am I supposed to? And then finally I realized in my senior year, well, no, you don't know anything about it. It's the first day. Just relax and try to understand what's going on. I guess that's kind of what they have to do, right?
Exactly. Pete Jenkins has a line. You know, Pete's 83 now and still coaching all over. And he's like, you know, I see it in the younger schools. You know, when somebody goes to pre-kindergarten to kindergarten, they sort of walk you around for a few days. Mm-hmm. You know, the kids, to get them accustomed to what's going on. And he's like, I don't know why we still don't, why we don't do that at older ages. You know, if you're hitting middle school for the first time, mm-hmm. or high school for the first time, or college for the first time, why we don't have more of that? Because there is that nervousness. First time you are at a new job. Yep. And that's what it is to these young men. You are at a new environment, a new job. And that's a lot of self-induced pressure.
Exactly. And you also... You ask yourself, am I a poser here or not? Do I really belong here or not, right? We'll talk about undrafted free agents real quick when we come back. Talking to Mike Dottiglia, interesting insights into what happens at the Saints rookie minicamp set to start today. The media has access on Saturday, 8:53, 7 till 9, traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:59, just a minute left with Mike Dottiglia. Saints rookie minicamp starts today. Saints, Mike, what about some undrafted free agents got your attention?
One guy who had a six-round pick grade from me, Marcus Yarns from Delaware, mm-hmm. shortcut runner. And he's quick. He's one-cut, get up the field, really, really tough, hard-nosed runner. He catches the ball well coming out of the backfield. The other one is a punter from Alabama, James Burnett. Mm-hmm. He's from Australia, all of 6 foot six. First, he struggled kicking in the States, and he talked about the heavy air of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, hitting a ball. But he got used to it, and he is going to push to make this roster. Burnup can hit it. He can flat out knock the air out of the football.
All right. Thank you, Mike Dottiglia. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll come back, talk about movies in our minds on WWL. 9:09 now on this Thursday morning. I've been looking forward to this hour. President Trump the other day was talking about tariffs on films, and he talked about propaganda and brainwashing occurring. You know, the president does want to wander off occasionally in movies, and that got me to thinking about, well, how easy is it to be manipulated by a film and subliminal things, this, that, the other thing, and why do movies make us feel the way they do? Pardon me. We're lucky enough to get in touch with James Cutting, Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, sir. Tell me about, I don't know, you know, I know you didn't come on to talk about this, but from the psychological standpoint of foreign films, and, you know, I remember seeing a thing years ago about, you know, they just have a frame quickly in a movie of a popcorn or a hot dog or something else to get you by a hot dog. Does any of that go on or not, or is that just all urban myth?
Most of that particular story is an urban myth, but movies are still very good at sort of controlling our emotions and making us understand things.
Let's talk about the evolution, if you will, of movies. I'm a movie buff, but I don't quite know why it is that I like them so much or what it is that I like about them. The basic movie is about storytelling, or beyond that, or are things going on and we don't realize? Take me through that.
Well, they're both of those. So, like you say, first of all, they tell stories. Popular movies usually make it fairly easy for people to understand those stories. They promote an emotional commitment, particularly to particular characters like the protagonist in the film. They also pretty much dictate where we're going to look on the screen. So they're controlling what we're supposed to attend to. And if you go to the movies in a theater rather than watching at home, the big screen really makes you feel like you're in the environment of the movie.
There is a difference, huh, the way the mind perceives it in a theater or at home?
Yeah, as it turns out, there is. When you have a big screen and it fills your visual field, it's going to be stimulating parts of the brain that wouldn't ordinarily be stimulated when you're watching, particularly if you're watching on a cell phone or an iPad or a computer. The bigness really does stimulate all kinds of things in your muscles, preparation to move, and other things as well.
It seems like back in the day they would love to come up with big summertime blockbusters where you would go into the theater and you'd escape the heat and the summertime in reality and go watch Indiana Jones and the Temple of whatever it was.
Sure.
Is the movie business still about that or not, Doc?
Well, there is. The summer blockbuster was... The concept was basically started with Jaws, and I think Jaws was, what, 1975? Late 70s, yeah, right like that. And, we can talk about making money because it's the summer blockbuster that used to carry a lot of the studios into profits. It's an interesting fact that some movies make an extraordinary amount of money, but most movies do not. And no one knows why a movie is going to make money. Sure, you put a star in it and you count on a little bit. You can do a remake and it might be as successful as the previous film and so forth. But it's a very tough business to be in.
When it comes to... manipulating us psychologically, is that what's going on to get us to like a movie? Is it all about the art? And here's the art, and I guess I'm wondering which comes first, Professor, because if I'm producing a product, I want to know what it is the consumer's going to want.
Sure.
And I understand that they used to test endings on movies and hand out cards back in the 40s, right? Way back in the day, they would explain that process, if you will, please, how we tend to think that what we see is a story, but there's a lot of psychological research that goes into what the finished product looks like, correct?
Well, the story should be fairly straightforward and easy to understand. And one way to do that is to have protagonists and antagonists. I'll just call them good guys and bad guys, although there could be females involved. And if you got good guys and bad guys, you got a simple story. And one of the ways to get your emotions associated with the good guys is through close-ups. So if the face of the protagonist appears large on the screen, it promotes a kind of intimacy with that character. And, you know, otherwise, why would this person be so large in my visual field? I mean, you only allow good friends and partners and that kind of close enough to you like that. So, you know, pretty soon you're identifying with the protagonist, and the protagonist feels like a friend because you have this large image of the individual. And, basically that's one of the methods that they use.
But as far as testing endings, sometimes they want they don't just have the story. They put it before audiences and test groups and determine which ending is going to be more popular, right?
They do indeed, and I think they still do that. I was only involved in that once. Yes, and that's part because they don't know what people are going to like by the end. What's interesting is that at the beginning, it's also very important. There are various kinds of rules for the idea that if you haven't grabbed the audience in the first 15 minutes, they're gone. People used to watch people sitting in the audience and see when they squirm. And if they squirm, that's not good. So you want a non-squirming audience. And so, you know, these are the various tricks and things that people have used. And, the rating system, I've read some books about how that is. It too is kind of a dicey business. I mean, there is I don't know how important it is these days, but word of mouth used to be very important in spreading information about whether people liked a movie or not.
When it comes to... art imitating life or life imitating art, I saw a story on Politico about some of the cardinals that are in a conclave actually took to the movie Conclave to see how it worked because they had never been through one before. The people that made the movie Conclave had never been through one, so they don't know what really happened. And I don't understand how. Tell me about art imitating life or life imitating art, and what takes the lead on that, Professor?
I hadn't heard that particular story. That's fabulous. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say. I mean, when people are telling stories, they want stories in the movies. They want stories to be believable. So that means that they can't deviate from what you would expect in life too much. And this excludes, obviously, the sci-fi movies and the Marvel movies and things like that, because no one can really fly or do all of this other kind of stuff. But that's, if you will, a kind of suspension of disbelief. But I think it would be very difficult to say. I mean, of course, there have been people who have gone out and done terrible things in part because they've seen them in the movies. I don't think that occurs very often, and I don't think too many people are affected that much. But the arena, historical dramas have always been popular in movies, where you essentially make up a story about Lincoln or Marie Antoinette or other historical figures. So that's certainly where the art is. Elaborating on real life, since we don't really know much about Marie Antoinette or Lincoln.
If I'm making a movie for a streaming service, or I'm making one to go into a theater, am I using a different approach psychologically to get people to like the film?
It's a good question, and I don't know. There are some movies, of course, that go straight to streaming, and others go to theaters for a couple of weeks. There have been movies that specify you have to go, you know, it has to be in the theater. And part of that is to capture the essence of seeing the big screen. Any movie that has got fabulous cinematography of large environments, you know, the Grand Canyon or the Alps or other kinds of places, is going to be much more effective. And, you know, Dr. Zhivago, with all this expansive stuff of the Russian snow and things like that, that's much more effective in the theater. But if it's a murder mystery, or if it's an office drama or something like that, a lot of those are going to happen inside, and so the big screen's not going to matter too much on that.
When it comes to holding our attention, it seems to me like sometimes when I'm watching a television sporting event, you know, for the love of God, or an award show, whatever it is, I don't watch a lot of award shows, but could you maybe stay on the shot for more than a second and a half so I can see what the hell it is I'm trying to see? Because yeah. they change a shot every second and a half. How has that changed in movies, or have you studied that at all?
No, I've studied that a lot, and you don't have enough time for me to go through all
this. I want to hear it, because the whole thing fascinates me about, you know, life so, imitating art and what's driving what here.
Right, so... From the 1930s to through the 1950s, the average shot length in movies was about 10 seconds. And then it began to gradually decline through about 2010 to about an average of 3.5 seconds. And I haven't seen any data which shows that it's gotten faster, but in part there's been a fairly recent fascination with long takes. Often at the beginning of movies, there'll be a shot that's digitally knit together that might be 2 minutes long or 10 minutes long or whatever, just to sort of get the audience into it. So average shot duration is probably 3.5, but of course it climaxes, in an Mission Impossible film or something like that. 1.5 seconds is about that. Most of that is to play on your emotions. It's not necessarily promoting your understanding of what's going on. So let me just give you a contrast between classic Hong Kong action films and classic Hollywood action films. Hollywood action films do make that cut like every, you know, second or second and a half. Hong Kong action films don't. They show a long shot of the protagonist doing something like a triple flip in the air, dragging their foot across the neck of the antagonist, and it's all done in one shot. And the reason for that is that Hong Kong films classically were interested in the artistry, the ability of the actor to do these wonderfully complicated things. And Hollywood films aren't interested in that. They just want you to be excited. I don't know what's happened to Hong Kong films now that they're sort of integrated into Chinese films and, you know, what's happened there. But it depends on the goals there. So when somebody is changing the shot duration every second and a half, they're not interested in having you understand anything. They just want you to be excited.
Is that a function of the director or of the editor when they put all this together?
Yeah, and the producer, too. I mean, the producer has ideas of what should happen. Mm-hmm. The director shapes those ideas, usually in conjunction with a producer. And the editor may have enough independence so that they can try out a bunch of different things. And the editor is certainly going to show various versions of a particular scene or group of scenes to the director. And I actually think that the editors do have a lot of control over what they're doing. But one thing about the control of gaze, which I talked about earlier, is that movie makers know where you're looking.
The control of what, Professor?
Sorry?
What'd you say, the control of what?
They control your gaze.
Oh, gaze, G-A-Z-E.
Where you're looking. Right.
Yeah, okay.
Where you're looking, yeah. Right. So they know where you're looking, and then in the next shot, they put up where you want to look in the next shot. So they superimpose where you ought to be looking on the screen, and that helps you to see the objects that are consecutively available in the movie, and to help you sort of understand at least a little bit of what's going on.
So what we're talking about is we are being intensely manipulated when we watch a movie and we don't realize it. Would that be accurate?
I don't know. Intensely, we're certainly being manipulated. We usually go in fully aware of what we want to see, and we want to experience a good story, right? Mm-hmm. And telling a good story is a very difficult thing. I mean, basically, a movie that makes money is usually a good story. But people don't really know how to tell what a good story is, whether it'll make money or not. So, you know, they're trying all kinds of things to make the story more interesting. And so they beef up trying to control where you're looking. They beef up what they think is the emotional content. I mean, the emotional content is often dictated by the music in the background, mm-hmm. right? I mean, they'll put on triumphal music when things are going well. They'll put on creepy music when things are kind of horrific. That's one of the ways in which they control your emotions.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because I was cooking something the other day and a movie was on the television. I don't know what movie it was, but I couldn't see it. And as I was chopping the food, I told the dog, something scary is about to happen.
Right.
And that's exactly what it was. All right, we'll pick it up right here. We come back, 9:25. We're having an interesting conversation about our minds and movies with James Cutting, Susan Lynn Sage, Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. He's done a lot of studies on this. We'll talk about nonlinear storytelling when we come back, and is there one way that's better than the other? And when it comes to the way movies have changed, the rhythms that they use in movies, and I guess that would be a combination both of the director and the editor and the producer, mirroring the human body. And I'll tell you about something I found out about jazz and a Geiger counter that blew my mind when I first heard about it. Back in a flash, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:31, 29 till 10. We started off with President Trump last week talking about movies and propaganda, and they got me to thinking about how movies influence your mind, and we found James Cutting, a Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University, author of Movies on Our Minds, The Evolution of Cinematic Engagement. And Professor, what led you as a psychologist to take on this mission or this work, if you will, with movies?
Yeah, good story. I've always been interested in perception, and I've always particularly been interested in visual perception. I've been interested in pictures, and it pretty much was movies was the kind of next thing that I might be interested in. But directly, I used to watch a lot of movies with my daughters, and anyone who's watched movies with children knows that you like to watch the same movie over and over and over again. And, you know, it's kind of fun to do that. But once you've seen a movie, and the particular movie I'm thinking about is Sound of Music, 1965, and I watched that movie many times with my daughters. And after watching it about 9 or 10 times, I began to be interested in how the movie was made, how it was put together. And that really led into a study of movies that I did for over 15 years.
In terms of why your daughters were so engaged in the movie, or want to see it over and over again?
No, that's certainly part of it. And some of the things we've already talked about with respect to, you know, close-ups and music and identifying and things like that. No, I mean, in other words, I'd already known the story. And I began to be interested in how the editors put together various scenes. And I began to notice that there were some inconsistencies across shots within the scene, and that implicated that some of the shots were taken in one take on one day and another take on another day. And then that led to just the investigation of, you know, what's going on here? What are the parameters that make an editor and director put all these things together?
So what goes on in our minds when we're watching a movie? Maybe it's a slasher movie or a horror movie. And let's talk about The Omen, for example, right, where that Rottweiler, whatever it is, where the woman shows up with a knife. I forgot exactly because it's been a while since I've seen the movie. But we know in our minds that there were sound technicians all over the place. There were set decorators. There were a bunch of people standing around smoking cigarettes, whatever, watching this being filmed, right?
Right.
But yet, yes, somehow in our mind, we allow ourselves to be terrified. What goes on in our mind for that to happen?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the things, one of the interesting ideas in philosophy and psychology is the emotions that we feel when we watch movies. So when we watch a horror film, we're scared, but there's a sense in which we know we're completely safe. Mm-hmm. Whereas if the same thing were happening in real life, we'd just be, the bejesus would be scared mm-hmm. out of us. And so it's as if we have these practice emotions that we can use in watching a popular film, and those practice emotions give us some ability to extend our experience. In other words, we like being scared as long as we're safe, and we like being in love even though we're just sitting in a chair. And, you know, all those things are emotions. Those are genuine emotions, but they don't have anything. They're experiential emotions that happen in watching and listening to a particular story, and we feel them, but they're not ones that are connected to everyday life.
I'm going to ask you a question here, and then Tim's going to give you my insurance information so you can build my insurance company, okay, doctor? And here's the question. Before Katrina, and you all know what happened. You know what happened with Katrina,
sure,
here, right? Before Katrina,
sure,
and writing it out here at the radio station, all that stuff, I hated horror movies. I couldn't stand them. After Katrina, I have no earthly idea. I couldn't get enough of them. What went on in my mind? Do you have any idea there what happened?
I don't, but it's interesting that perhaps the horror movie lets you experience or re-experience some of the emotions that you were genuinely going on during Katrina, but you were in a safe place. So you got to experience the range of emotions or some of the range of emotions, but knowing that, you know, this is not a real thing. This is not like, you know, floods coming in hospitals and people stranded on roofs and things like that. So there's something about there's a whole, you know, I don't think anyone really understands why horror films are so effective, but they certainly are. And I think it's the idea of being able to experience these extreme emotions in a safe place.
So you talk about rhythms in movies that are not unlike those of the human body. And I mentioned that I learned the other day, and I didn't realize that such a thing existed, plutonium jazz, a short-lived unique jazz genre that gained popularity in the 40s where bass players would synchronize their beats with the clicks of a Geiger counter, but they had to stop doing it because people were getting radiation poisoning.
Well, I don't know about that.
No, I'm telling you, that's a fact. That's what my research shows me. But when it comes to filmmakers and rhythms of the body, how do they – tell me about that.
Well, I think it's all done intuitively. I've actually worked with a filmmaker on looking at various drafts of the film and then looking at the final film. And there's simultaneous rhythms that go on. I mean, these would be represented in a Geiger counter, the clicks there too. But let's think of it this way. There are three things that we pretty much all do. We breathe, and we tend to breathe 10 times a minute or so. Our heart beats, and you know that depends on what we're doing, but it might be from 50 to 80 times a minute. And most all of us can walk, and we can walk at various kinds of speeds. Now, if we're walking, our heart is beating, and we're also breathing. But what's interesting is that those three patterns are not synchronized. So in other words, when you're taking your breath, it's not the case that your heart is beating at a particular time or that you're taking a particular step. Those go on simultaneously, and that's life. That's perfectly natural. And so what I think filmmakers do when they make film is the people who are filmmakers and write about film say that they're interested in a particular rhythm that a scene will have or a bunch of scenes together. And, you know, there's a whole lot of mathematical analysis that I've gone into there, but it's not it's not executable very fast. But the whole idea is that what filmmakers are doing, particularly editors, is that they are creating simultaneous rhythms in a film that are not unlike the rhythms of breathing, heartbeats, and walking.
So let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about movies are definitely manipulating us one way or the other. And is there any watchdog, any way of making sure that we're not being manipulated in one way or the other to our detriment? And I know there are movies that, you know, they're so-called documentaries that are designed to elicit a response from you one way or the other or lead you in one direction or the other. We're talking to James Cutting, Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University, about why do movies make us feel the way they do and what's going on in our brain. If you have any questions or comments, you can text them in to 504-260-1870. Right now, time for traffic on WWL. 9:46, 14 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Having an interesting hour here with Dr. James Cutting. He is a Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department at Cornell University. And he wrote the book I got in front of me here, Movies on Our Minds, and it goes to how our movies draw us in and what do they do to us psychologically. So, Professor, when it comes to so-called documentaries, and I don't know how you can find, you know, again, this goes to, and this job has really driven me crazy because I don't know what absolute truth is. I don't know how you find absolute truth because there are so many different gradients, and to tell the entire story behind anything would be volumes and volumes if you're going to give every offshoot and this and that and the other thing. So it's generalizations a lot of times. But when it comes to documentaries, are there some ways that people can notice whether or not they're intentionally being manipulated or some warning signs?
Probably only if they know in advance a little bit about the area that is being covered in the documentary. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about documentaries is that they, over the last 25 years, have been the fastest growing genre of film. It's not exactly the case that you can call them popular films, but mm-hmm. they are certainly produced. I think one of the things that makes a documentary so easy to make is that it's generally cheap. Mm-hmm. You don't need CGI. You don't need color toning. You don't need a lot of the other things that go on. You can use a voiceover narration over the shots, and the voiceover can say anything that you want. In other words, they're relatively easy to make. You don't have a whole lot of rapid shots that are only, you know, a second and a half long, like we were talking about earlier. So they're cheap, and of course, people make them for particular reasons. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to tell whether what is truth. You're exactly right, but I don't know how to tell from a documentary whether it's telling the truth or not, because you usually don't get a chance to check. I mean, just like any bit of news, I like to check from at least two sources to see if what I'm hearing is something I should believe in or not, if it's important enough for me to find out.
Are you concerned with any kind of, as a psychologist, any kind of manipulation going on with films that, you know, because again, they're designed to manipulate us because they want us to want to watch the movie, right? And want to pay to see it or whatever. So is there any safeguard against some kind of negative manipulation? Are you concerned at all as a psychologist that that's going on, that all of us are being somehow brainwashed into doing this or that or the other thing?
Well, I guess what worries me most about sort of contemporary filmmaking is the fact that you can have AI-generated characters that look exactly like the real ones. Mm-hmm. So you can make, if you will, fake histories with people. It looks like, you know, politicians or anybody else that you think you know about, and it will appear to be the truth when in fact it's just a figment of somebody's computer engineering. Yeah, that scares me a lot.
When it comes to engagement of people, and somebody texting about losing a child and watching movies, whether or not their spouse should watch a movie or not, how do you come up as a psychologist and a man who studied film? What would you advise people as to, maybe if you're going through this, you shouldn't watch that. Maybe if you're not going through this, you should watch. You understand what I'm asking you?
Yeah, I do understand what you're asking. And I think, if you're going through a tough patch, I think you have to find out a little bit about more information about what it is that you might be going to watch, and then just decide whether to do it or not. I mean, I sort of had an experience with this a little while ago when the movie 12 Years a Slave came out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very much against, if you will, white civilization in America at a particular time. And I had to prepare myself for that. And the film was incredibly powerful, and I'm very glad I saw it, but it took me a while to get myself in a place that I could watch that and appreciate it. So I think that kind of thing happens in a lot of different circumstances. I mean, you know, some people, you walk into a situation and say, you know, do I really want to see an action film right now, or would I rather see a bromance or something like that? And so, yeah, okay, you make a decision. I think some of that decision is based on how you feel at a given moment, and then some of that decision is based on what you've been through and any, particular agony that you've had about a particular topic. So, yeah, you know, I would say, you know, find out more about what it is that you might watch and ask people who have seen it. And, you know, is it going to be right for me? And sometimes it will be and sometimes not.
I can't thank you enough, Tom, for your professor. Films fascinate me. The human mind fascinates me, and you fascinate me because you put them all together. James E. Cutting, the book is Movies on Our Minds. He's a Susan Lynn Sage Professor Emeritus, Psychology Department. at Cornell University. And when it comes to truth, I don't know what absolute truth there is or what it looks like. 9:53, back in a flash, WWL.